Good Tuesday morning, everybody, and welcome to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee here today. I see a quorum is present. I'd like to ask Vice Chair Mecklen if he's had a chance to review the minutes from our last meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have read the minutes from March 6, 2025, and I move them.
Any further comments, members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes have been approved. Thank you. Members, we have three very important bills today, we need to keep things moving along pretty well. Our first bill up is House File 1768. If Representative Leader Niska could come forward. We do have a number of testifiers, and again, I'm going to ask the testifiers to try to keep their testimony between 2 minutes or so, right around that two-minute mark. And the plan for this is to move it on to the General Register. So with that, the chair will move House File 1768 in front of the committee, and we will refer this to the General Register. Leader Niska, welcome to the committee, and please proceed with your bill.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Baker and committee. Happy to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about House File 1768, which is an important effort to fix some of the problems that were created by the blanket non-compete ban that was passed by the legislature in 2023. And if you remember, there was a more limited non-compete or ban on non-competition agreements that was heard, that was being discussed within the House. And then this version that ultimately passed into law was airdropped into a conference committee report at the end without a lot of discussion. And that has created some issues in Minnesota's economy, and in particular in our economy as it relates to the important innovation base that we have in Minnesota. We have a very knowledgeable workforce, a very good workforce, and a business economy that depends on research and development, on innovation, and that the way that the non-compete ban currently works harms that the ability of Minnesota to compete in that area. In order to make and keep Minnesota an attractive place to innovate, companies that want to do research and development and innovation in Minnesota need to have the tools to protect their trade secrets. And unfortunately, sometimes that means that for some employers, for some employees, they need the ability to negotiate not just non-disclosure agreements, but non-competition agreements for certain kinds of employees. If non-competes are permitted, as they were in certain circumstances before the blanket non-compete ban is in place, it's important to remember that they have to still be reasonable. There are court tests that look at reasonable duration, reasonable geography. They still have to be negotiated. And so what we're talking about is situations in which an employer and an employee are permitted to negotiate a non-compete agreement. We think that House File 1768 creates a tailored fix of the non-compete ban to cover two particular categories where it's not only fair for a non-compete to be negotiated, but important for Minnesota's innovation economy that non-compete agreements can be negotiated between employees and employers. Number one is specific types of employees over an income threshold where they are specifically directly involved in research and development, where they're specifically involved in creating confidential information, trade secrets. And the second is those very high income employees, over $500,000 of income, where those employees really do have a lot of negotiating leverage and a lot of negotiating power. And in those circumstances, it's fair and sometimes necessary for the employer and the employee to negotiate terms around whether they can leave that and go to an employer. So that's House File 1768. Again, I appreciate the time and consideration before the committee, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Leader Niska. We're going to get to the testifiers. If I could ask Ms. Schotthorst to come forward, as well as if Mr. Zellers could also join her at the other open chair, we're going to try to keep this moving along. And then on deck would be Mr. Mick. So good morning, Ms. Schotthorst, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schotthorst, and I'm a policy director for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, a statewide organization representing more than 6,300 businesses and 500,000 employees throughout the state. I'm also testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota Manufacturers Council. Manufacturing is the second largest industry sector of our membership, and the Chamber serves as the state affiliate for NAM, the National Association of Manufacturers. Thank you for the opportunity to support House File 1768, a targeted balancing modification to Minnesota's existing outright prohibition on non-compete agreements. In 2023, when the state pursued this complete prohibition, we shared our opposition to that effort. Non-compete agreements are a valid tool for employers to protect legitimate employer interests. When done properly, Minnesota courts have long agreed, and the existing non-compete viability test has been widely regarded as fair to both employer and employee. We did not, however, object to adding protections for employees in the context of putting parameters around non-competes, an approach taken by many other states that regulate them. House File 1768 introduces a more appropriate reasonableness factor back into Minnesota's non-compete regulatory landscape. Wage thresholds can protect lower-wage employees and support worker mobility while applying targeted non-compete provisions to highly compensated employees in roles directly involved in research, development, and trade secret management protects vital business interests. An outright prohibition on non-compete agreements stifles innovation and threatens the ingenuity that Minnesota uses to establish itself as a worldwide leader in product development and innovation. This bill strikes an appropriate balance. We appreciate the opportunity to share our support for this bill with the committee today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Zellers, to the committee. Please introduce yourself and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kurt Zellers, CEO for the Minnesota Business Partnership. And I'm here today to give the full and unequivocated support for House File 1768. The Minnesota Business Partnership is home to some of our longest legacy and historic Minnesota companies, many of them who are family names, many of you who have friends, relatives, neighbors who have worked for them. We have over 500,000 Minnesota MBP employees here in the state, but 4.8 million globally. So I just want to make sure and leave that little number with you. 4.8 million employees globally work for Minnesota Business Partnership member companies. So when we look at this bill and we look at how we're competitive, not just here in Minnesota, the Midwest, but across North America, our member companies look globally. And what House File 1768 does is bring that competitive advantage back into not only here in Minnesota, but North America and globally. I applaud some of the members of the committee who were here before and righted some wrongs. Hourly wage worker contracts should not have non-compete agreements in there. That simply was not a good idea. However, making us uncompetitive when it comes to protecting not only the specific devices or innovations, but the processes that make our Minnesota companies not only competitive globally, but global leaders in what they do. So House File 1768 brings that competitive advantage back to Minnesota. It does not include some of the things. You know, I'm not a big opponent of one radio guy going to another radio station or one meteorologist going from her current TV station to another, absolutely not. But what we do need to protect is that intellectual property and the process. What many of our member companies have told me is it's not just the device or the object or the piece of equipment. It is how that equipment is assembled, how they go through the process, whether it's the innovation side, testing, beta testing, and then bringing to scale, or it is how they have perfected over time, not only the beginning parts of it, but then how they continue to grow globally. So House File 1768 does just that, make sure that we take that competitive advantage here, not only globally. I will tell you, California is the only other modern version of a non-compete agreement. And I can, you know, there are many reasons why the businesses are leaving California. I would say, especially from a tech standpoint, this is a number one thing that's costing them jobs. We want to have not only 500,000 Minnesotans, but maybe even 600,000 Minnesota member company employees in the coming future. This bill helps us do that. I appreciate the committee time, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Zellers. Appreciate it. Next up is Ryan Mick. And then we'll have a Zoom following Mr. Mick, and then Hunter Cantrell will be up on deck after Mr. Mick at the table. So, good morning. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ryan Mick. I'm an attorney, and I represent the Minnesota Employment Law Council, which is a consortium of some of Minnesota's largest employers. Listen, the issue of non-competes involves competing interests. No one speaking up here today is against employee mobility. As Mr. Zeller says, there's no dispute that low-wage workers should not be subject to non-competes. But employers, our existing entrepreneurs, our existing job creators, have legitimate interests too. They have a legitimate interest in not having key personnel who are involved in R&D and strategy walk out with all of that information, all of that key confidential trade secret information in their head and go to a competitor. That's a legitimate interest. If they've invested their resources and their goodwill in an executive or a sales leader, making that person the face of the company and part of the market, they have a legitimate interest in being able to substitute somebody else in with that representation of goodwill before the existing, the prior person, goes across the street and starts representing, working for a competitor. Those are legitimate interests. Often it's both of those things. Confidential information, trade secrets, goodwill, all of those things are at issue. Now, there are policy judgments to be made, where to draw the lines between those interests. But the 2023 blanket non-compete ban completely eviscerated one side of that equation. That's bad for job creators, and as you've heard, that's bad for Minnesota because we are not as competitive. I have heard employers having those conversations. Can we have this executive? Can we have this strategy leader? Can we have this R&D function here? Because there are more protections elsewhere, 47, 48, 49 other states. Those conversations are happening. Those moves are happening. This bill is good policy. It draws an appropriate balance between those two sides of the coin. It has clear lines in terms of the income threshold, so those are applicable by the courts and understandable by the employees and the employers, and it appropriately balances these interests in the key areas where we're talking about, confidential information, trade secrets, and those most substantial employees. This bill won't lock anybody out, won't lock anybody in. They can still move. All we're talking about is traditionally those sorts of agreements that for a limited period of time, in a limited geographic scope, for a limited purpose, keep people from going to a direct competitor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mack. Appreciate it. Next up is Hannah Garden Mohayat. I'm going to ask her to pronounce that for me. And you are on Zoom. So good morning, Hannah, and welcome. Please proceed. And after you introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, sir, and thank you all for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Hannah Garden-Monheit. I'm a senior fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project, a nonpartisan nonprofit dedicated to challenging monopolies' dominance over markets and society. And until recently, I served as the director of the Federal Trade Commission's Office of Policy Planning, where I led the agency's work tackling non-competes. I also previously served as President Biden's Competition Council Director, leading the Biden-Harris administration's all-of-government effort to promote competition. Today, I'd like to share with you insights and evidence about the harmful effects of non-competes obtained during my time at the FTC that may be helpful to you as you consider House File 1768, which I urge you all to vote against. The FTC comprehensively reviewed the empirical literature on non-competes, conducted its own economic analysis, and reviewed public input. The overwhelming evidence showed that non-competes prevent free and fair competition, unsurprisingly, given it's right there in their name. By preventing employers from competing to hire the best worker for the job and by preventing workers from starting new competing businesses, non-competes suppress wages, reduce new business formation, and stifle innovation. And that's true for both non-competes with low-income workers, but also high-income workers. We found those negative effects across the income spectrum. Based on this evidence, the FTC adopted a categorical non-compete ban, but it is not in effect due to ongoing litigation by big corporate interest groups. That makes it all the more important that Minnesota not cut back on the important protections that Governor Waltz signed into law in 2023. By the way, the vast majority of the public commenters to the FTC, including 97% of the comments from Minnesotans, supported a comprehensive ban on non-competes regardless of income. For example, Cole, an engineer in the technology field in Minnesota, wrote to the FTC that, and I'm quoting here, non-compete agreements negatively impact innovation because engineers are prevented from moving to new teams within their industry working on new technology to displace existing technologies owned by large corporations. We also heard from Ben, a doctor in a pediatric subspecialty at a children's hospital in Minnesota. Even though you might at first blush think of him as someone with a lot of bargaining power, he explained that because his expertise is so specialized, there are very few places he can practice medicine, and now a non-compete is trapping him in place. We heard many, many stories like these, stories that helped us understand that non-competes are not just a problem when it comes to low-income workers. When it comes to highly skilled workers, and yes, even highly compensated ones, non-competes impose harmful negative externalities on our economy. Non-competes prevent these workers from efficiently matching with the best firm for their skill set or from starting their own new businesses. And that in turn deprives the rest of us of innovative new products, increased productivity, and lower prices. Indeed, as we examine the market effects of non-competes at the FTC, our economic experts actually found that in many ways, it was more important to the economy to ban non-competes for highly skilled workers like senior executives than for low-income workers, because the mobility of these types of professionals drives new business formation, innovation, and increases the productivity of firms. For example, it is highly paid, highly skilled professionals who are most likely to have the expertise and the capital to start new competing businesses and to lead the research and development processes that produce new innovations. Consider, for example, the Stanford geneticist.
I'm sorry, yes, and if you could just wrap it up, we're at a little bit, almost four minutes, so thank you.
Yes, sir, apologies. We heard from a Stanford geneticist who wanted to start a biotech firm, but he wasn't able to hire the most talented scientists to work with him because they were locked up by non-competes at big pharma companies. So imagine the cures and treatments and innovations we're missing out on when non-competes are trapping people from matching with an appropriate firm. And in fact, we see that dominant corporations often use non-competes to lock up talent, precisely to lock out new market entrants who would compete with them. At the FTC, we also examined corporations' claimed business interests, and what we found is that corporations have more narrowly tailored options to protect their legitimate business interests, such as patent law, trade secrets, non-disclosure agreements, fixed-term contracts with their workers, and so forth, and of course, competing on the merits to retain your workers. And finally, I'll just close by noting that non-competes have been categorically void across the income spectrum in California, North Dakota, and Oklahoma since the 1800s, to very IP-intensive fields that require highly skilled workers have flourished in those states, and we haven't seen the sky fall there, just like we haven't seen any evidence of it falling in Minnesota yet. So I urge you all to retain Minnesota's non-compete law in full. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cantrell, if you would come forward, please. And then Brian is on deck as well in Zoom. And again, I just want to remind everybody we're trying to save between 2 and 3 minutes. Thank you. Welcome, Hunter. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Hunter Cantrell. I'm a medical student at the University of Minnesota. And I'm here today to urge you to oppose House File 1768. Non-compete clauses harm the economic freedom of all hardworking people who have spent their time, energy, and money developing their skills to power our economy. As healthcare providers, we make new discoveries through caring for our patients and performing research every day. In this bill, as written, essentially any employer could classify our work as research and development for the purpose of enforcing a non-compete clause and holding workers hostage on the vague premises of protecting trade secrets that in reality are just the hard-earned wisdom of medical practice. In fact, that's what the companies and institutions we work for often do with our intellectual property. A few years before non-competes were banned in Minnesota, I spoke to a new surgeon who had just started working in a private practice in the Twin Cities that soon thereafter sold to private equity. The new management offered him a much worse contract, and he walked away. They had done nothing to develop his talents or provide him with unique proprietary knowledge. Yet the new management, purely out of spite, went on to enforce his original non-compete agreement with the predecessor practice, depriving his patients of care by prohibiting this surgeon with a new family from practicing medicine in Minnesota for the next 18 months. He had not engaged in a voluntary contractual relationship with this new entity, yet by virtue of growing monopolies in healthcare and other sectors, they used the anti-competitive restraint of non-competes to harm his career. I worry in particular about the impact of this bill on women in STEM, many of whom meet the salary minimum in the bill by early to mid-career, and who unfortunately still face rampant discrimination in the workforce to this day. If they are passed over for job promotions, or if workers are facing a harmful work environment in general, this bill would essentially be a career-ending measure for them if they seek to apply their valuable talents elsewhere. If workplaces are concerned about employees leaving, the answer is not to legally compel them to stay or otherwise face financial ruin. The answer is to cultivate a positive work environment where workers are treated with respect for the work they do. The driving force of all industry and innovation lies not in the C-suite or the boardroom, but in the labor of workers. In close, I will say this. At a time when billionaires and large corporations are the wealthiest and most powerful they have ever been, with big monopolies swallowing up entire economic sectors, including healthcare, we need to be doing everything possible to strengthen protections and economic opportunities for working people, without whom no profits nor industry are possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cantrell. Welcome, Brian Colazzi. He'll be also on Zoom call, and then next up would be Dr. Shannon Neal at the testifying table. So, Brian, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Chair Baker and committee members, for the opportunity to testify. Thanks for getting my name right. My name's Brian Colazzi. I'm chief economist at the Open Markets Institute, which is an anti-monopoly think tank based in Washington, D.C. And I've written and published widely on coercive contracts imposed on workers and small business owners in academic journals and elsewhere. So Minnesota's non-compete law passed in 2023 was a major step forward to eliminate these kinds of pernicious contracts for all workers, irrespective of their income, line of work, or employment classification. However, House File 1768 seeks to exempt employees involved in research and development and employees with responsibility over trade secrets from the protections of non-compete law. In my view, this is misguided for several reasons. First of all, employers' use of non-compete clauses has adverse effects not only on workers, but on competitors and consumers. These effects, as others have said earlier, are seen most clearly for precisely the high-wage employees that House File 1768 seeks to exempt. The use of non-compete clauses by incoming corporations for specialized workers slows the entry and growth of new firms. We have a number of papers in journals showing that. By tying up specialized workers with non-compete clauses, dominant firms can prevent new entrants and small rivals from hiring the labor they need to compete effectively and grow. This fortification of monopoly power can inflict significant and durable injuries on consumers who pay higher prices and are deprived of higher quality goods and services. The classic example here is Massachusetts versus California. Massachusetts, with Cambridge, MIT, and Boston, had the head start in the tech industry. California zoomed ahead of them in the 1970s and 80s and 90s because non-competes are not enforceable in California. And we have this Silicon Valley today, largely as a result of the non-enforceability of non-competes, as we heard, dating back to the 19th century. To the extent employers do need to safeguard proprietary information, trade secret laws already protect employers against the theft of trade secrets. Whereas, in contrast, non-competes are overbroad, they restrain worker mobility with the purported aim of protecting business information, even if the information is dated or trivial, a training manual from 10 years ago. And at the same time, non-competes don't prevent employees from sharing trade secrets during the term of employment. So they're also too narrow. They're not really the right tool for the job. So I'll just close by saying, whereas the harms from non-compete are real and well-documented, the justification for these contracts is rather unpersuasive. A categorical ban on these contracts, as the bill in 2023 did, is the correct policy. Minnesota's current law does just that, and it should maintain this universal approach and not include any carve-outs tied to income, line of work, or employment status. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And thank you, Mr. Colazzi. I think I got the name better this time, so I appreciate your time today. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Neal. Please introduce yourself and continue.
Chair Baker and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Dr. Shannon Neal. I'm a family physician practicing at Park Nicollet Clinic and a faculty member at the University of Minnesota Department of Family Medicine and Community Health. Today, I am here representing the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians and the Minnesota Medical Association to share our concerns with HF 1768, which would permit the enforcement of non-compete clauses under certain conditions. As we read this bill, we believe it will apply to healthcare workers making over $120,000 due to the confidential nature of the physician-patient relationship. Non-compete clauses in healthcare are harmful to both physicians and the communities that we serve. These restrictive covenants do not enhance patient care or improve healthcare access. Rather, they limit physician mobility, restrict patient choice, and exacerbate physician shortages, particularly in underserved and rural areas. as a physician, my foremost responsibility is to my patients. When non-compete clauses are enforced, they create unnecessary barriers that can disrupt continuity of care. If an employer prohibits a physician from practicing in their region after they leave that practice, patients are often left scrambling to find new providers, which can lead to delays in treatment, worsened health outcomes, and strain on a system that's already overburdened. I was the family medicine department chair of my organization for 9 years, and I heard many stories from the physicians I recruited and interviewed for job interviews about how non-competes were forcing them to leave their communities. While I was always glad to hire an excellent physician, as someone who grew up in rural Minnesota, it was heartbreaking to know that a rural community was losing a valuable asset. Physicians don't randomly decide to leave their practices. We're committed to our patients and to our communities. When we choose to leave our practice, it's usually due to changes in family circumstances. However, in worst-case scenarios, it could be due to being treated poorly at the organization we're currently working for. Non-compete agreements tend to disproportionately impact younger physicians who may have fewer resources to challenge restrictive contracts. When residents come out of training, they have very little bargaining power. If their employer requires a non-compete, they have very few options after establishing a practice. These agreements can suppress wages, limit career advancement, and discourage physicians from practicing in the very communities that need them the most. With the consolidation of independent practices that's occurring in healthcare, there are often larger health systems that have multiple sites throughout a region. If one of these systems has a non-compete that prohibits practice within 20 miles of their location, a physician could, for example, be prohibited from practicing in the entire Twin Cities area. In a rural area, a non-compete could be for several hundred miles. When I was chair and we hired a physician from another healthcare organization in the metro region and they had a non-compete, we were frequently put in the position of having to place that physician at a clinic outside of their non-compete range for the specified period of time, usually at least 2 years. After that time, they could go to a clinic of their choice. This, of course, disrupted not only the current clinic, but individual patient care. At a time when physician burnout is at an all-time high, we should be working to retain and support healthcare providers, not trapping them in restrictive agreements that stifle competition and ultimately harm public health. We urge you to instead support policies that foster a more flexible, patient-centered healthcare system. Thank you for your time today and consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Neal. That concludes our signed up testimony ahead of time. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, we'll close testimony and I'll take it to member questions. Anyone? Representative Pete Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker, Representative Niska, for bringing this bill forward. The first couple questions I have, I'm hoping maybe nonpartisan staff can answer. Do we have definitions for what annual budgeted compensation would be?
Ms. Choline?
Chair and members, there's no definition in the bill itself. This is not an area I usually cover, so I would need to look into if there's a definition elsewhere in the chapter. My interpretation of annual budget compensation was that included the budget that the employer had for things like health care and so on that are part of a person's compensation package.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Next question would be definitions for proprietary, confidential, and research and development.
Ms. Choline.
Chair and members, again, I would need to check other parts in the chapter to be sure, but there's nothing included within this bill.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker. My question, I guess, for the bill author would be, if we count things like health insurance, other fringe benefits that they're accounting for in that wage, along with their salaries, it doesn't take a whole lot to get over that $120,000 threshold, especially if they're offering a decent health insurance plan. So my concern would be with that lower bar than just the $120,000 plus in a company's ability to call what they are doing proprietary or confidential, paired with creation or modification in that research and development piece, that manufacturer workers who are on something like family health insurance would be potentially held to one of these non-compete clauses. And I don't think that that is the intention of, based on all the testimony here today, for folks both for and against this bill. It seems like nobody wants workers. We're talking about these high level things for the trade secrets, which my understanding is we have laws in place to protect those. So my question would be, are you concerned about this being more broadly applied without the lack of definitions as well as the increased value of that annual compensation?
Leader Niska.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and thank you for that question, Representative Johnson. So I think a couple of contextual pieces. First of all, I would say happy to have a discussion about what exactly is the right threshold. Obviously, as you are getting at the annual budgeted compensation is trying to make an apples to apples, all in, what is your total compensation, salary, bonuses, fringe benefits, whether 120,000 is the right number or not. I was certainly happy to have that conversation with anyone who wants to have that conversation. Important other piece of context is that in a non-compete, that's an employment agreement with a non-competition provision, that's going to have to be disclosed to the employee that they fit into this category. It's a topic of conversation, I think, that's going to have to happen at that level. Certainly, the idea of someone having primary duties, including research and development or the creation, analysis, or modification of confidential, proprietary, or trade secret information. I think the legal meaning of all of those terms, even if they're not defined in this, I don't think a court is going to, and certainly it's not my intent that would cover, a manufacturing line worker. I don't think that would be a reasonable interpretation of any of the words in that, but certainly open to refinement of definitions of any of those terms to make that clear if anyone wants to work on that.
Follow up, Representative Johnson. Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Niska, for letting us talk about this bill. I wanted to follow up on something that Representative Johnson asked about, because I think it is sort of definitive in the conversation we had 2 years ago, also that happened in the Senate, which is the line drawing issue. It was brought up by actually folks opposed to the bill. At that point, there was, for the last 4 years, there was a line drawing of 85,000 or 100,000, and the employment lawyers who were really against it said, like, well, how do you draw that line? And so one of the ways not to deal with that is just not to have a line. But you have a line in compensation and also in research and development or the creation or analysis or modification of confidential and proprietary information or trade secrets. And I looked, and I don't think I saw anywhere a definition in statute that of research and development. Can you describe how broadly or narrowly and give specifics about where you think who you think we're covering with the research and development and I guess or the creation or analysis of modification of confidential and proprietary information and trade secrets?
Leader Niska.
Thank you, Chair Baker and Representative Greenman. I think the other important driver is primary duties, right? That's the employee's primary duties have to include research and development. So we're talking about people who are working on developing medical devices, working on developing proprietary business processes, the types of people who, even if they don't download a flash drive of their documents, they have information in their head that is the proprietary trade secret of their employer. When they walk off the job and go to a competitor, they are just by working at that competitor compromising the innovation, the business interests of their employer, their previous employer. Those are the types of people that we're trying to cover under the primary job duties definition, that threshold. I would point out as well, when we're talking about line drawing, virtually every other state has line drawing using income thresholds. In fact, to Representative Johnson's point about 120,000 being a low threshold, it's actually quite a bit higher than the thresholds that are in a lot of other states on non-competition agreements. But again, I'm happy to work with anybody on trying to narrowly tailor this as much as possible to the particular types of people we're talking about, the medical device engineer, the coder, someone who's actually involved in the actual innovation of products. or business process, where just by walking off the job and going to a competitor, or walking off the job and starting a competitor, they have taken away the proprietary information, the proprietary, and harmed the business interests of their previous employer, who, as we heard from the testimony, might decide not to invest in Minnesota, not to have that job function in Minnesota, if they can't protect that that proprietary information in Minnesota.
Follow-up, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Chair Baker. One of the things when I was talking to, I noticed, as we have heard, we heard a lot from the biggest businesses who have a dog in this fight, right? They have a dog in this fight in protecting their specialization, their workers, who give them an advantage, who've built up that business. We didn't hear, we did hear from some workers, but not testifying in favor of this bill. I spent the weekend talking to workers who hired engineers, folks who would meet that $120,000 threshold. And one of the things they said is, reading this bill, one, it wouldn't just be the engineers, it would also be the people in operations who develop the operations in order to produce that product. It may be the sales folks who are deeply, deeply engaged at the from the beginning to the end in terms of making sure that there's a market. And so when we think about primary duties of research and development, the creation analysis. Now, what I'm wondering, because I heard balance, I heard that this strikes the right balance, I heard that, I think, from either the business partnership or the chamber, who represent the biggest businesses and are well represented. One of the things I'm wondering is, we have trade secrets laws, we have non-solicitation laws that prohibit, so trade secret laws prevent you from doing exactly what you said, walking off with that secret sauce and going somewhere else. Non-solicitation agreements, which prevent you from, and are legal in Minnesota, which allow you to say you can't walk off on any of those relationships. We have non-disclosure agreements, which protect a broader set of information within a firm, and the list goes on. But trade secret laws, my understanding, as someone who's not practiced it, but I practiced a bit of non-compete laws, and trade secret laws are tight. When I was looking at the damages, and you can get injunctions, you can get damages, you can get attorney's fees. So my understanding from folks who work in this field is, very strong hammer to deal with this. And so if what about this non-compete ban, particularly for these industries, do you think Minnesota needs, that isn't covered by trade secrets, non-disclosure agreements, non-solicitation agreements? And I think there's probably a list of other protections that we give workers to protect their IP and their business interests.
Leader Niska.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and thank you for that question, Representative Greenman. That's exactly the right question, and I think if you would actually talk to someone who's tried to litigate a case in which someone doesn't take the flash drive with documents, but just goes out the door with the information in their head, whether we're talking about business practices, whether we're talking about other types of trade secrets, that's extremely difficult to prove, to even get past the pleading stage, to get into discovery, to find out how that other competing business is using that information. And that's the reason why this is an important tool in the toolbox. Trade secret laws, yes, are a hammer if you can prove it up, if you can show that, in fact, this worker went and said, okay, now I'm drawing out all the things that I remember from yesterday when I was at the other employer. But if you've ever actually had to litigate one of those, and Mr. Mick, I know, has litigated more of those than I have, but I have been involved in litigating non-competition, non-solicitation cases, and that's the real problem. That's the challenge, is that there are ways that a business's proprietary information can be stolen in ways that are impossible, if not difficult, if not impossible, to prove. The one other point I would say is, I don't believe that we have a lot of testimony here from the businesses who want to steal trade secrets from other companies, because you don't get people coming here and saying that would be a good thing. But that is, I mean, when we're talking about innovation, when we're talking about, one of the witnesses was talking about the example of California, some of that innovation is because trade secrets are stolen. That is not something that I think any of us in this room are going to say is a good thing. It does happen, and part of the point of this legislation is to give one more tool in the toolbox to the companies who are concerned about having their proprietary information stolen. And I think in some cases it's a necessary tool. We're trying to tailor it to the places where it's specifically necessary.
Mr. Chair.
Final, because I got to move on. I got three more testifiers, and we got to move to the next bill.
Thank you. I appreciate
quickly,
this.
Briefly,
this is,
yep.
This is my bill. The thing I hear today is we heard economists, we heard researchers, we heard evidence, we heard workers versus the word of the biggest dominant companies with a dog in this fight. And so when I think about the balance we need to strike, I think it's the balance for fair markets. It's the balance for competition and innovation. It's the balance for workers. And to me, that is the balance we struck with this bill. Members, this is an attempt, and the reason that there's no definitions, the reason that it is broad is an attempt to skirt around the sky hasn't fallen. It's an attempt to skirt around a good bill. So I'd ask members to vote no.
Representative Wayne Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Thank you, Representative Niska, for bringing this forward. One of the things that I noticed in here that seems to be missed here is part of this is agreement is part of the word. And that when you're sitting down to negotiating a contract or employer contract or agreement, whether it includes health care, whether it includes time off or whatever and stuff like that, part of this is the negotiation for the non-compete or non-disclosure agreement. So in other words, you're receiving compensation along with this agreement, and that at that time, you can choose yes or no that you want to move forward, just like you do with your normal package, pay package that you decide to do it. This isn't something that's just going to be thrown on somebody that's already working and to say, oh, by the way, you're going to lose your job tomorrow if you don't sign this agreement today. I believe that's not allowed. Is that correct?
Leader Niska.
Thank you, Chair Baker and Representative Johnson. That is correct, yes.
Follow up?
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am recalling this conversation from 2024, and a lot of the members around the table were there for that. And if I'm remembering this correctly, we spent the majority of the time around this underlying statute talking about sandwich artists around the Twin Cities, if I'm remembering correctly. And I think it's really important that we deal with this bill today because of how many employers work with information that would be considered confidential, proprietary, and trade secret information. It's been made mention around this table that there has been a lot. The attempt in this bill, which, by the way, it's not in the form that it was when it was in the Labor Committee in 2024, that the attempt was to keep it broad so it could apply equally. And yet at the same time, the questions from the other side of the aisle have in somewhat been, why aren't we defining certain things? Why aren't we doing this? And I think that maybe this was just an oversight or something that we didn't get into enough last year. And I see this bill as just a fix to what is already in law. Because I really do, for the sake of our employers in Minnesota and wanting to have a thriving economy in our state, I think that this is important to provide some additional definitions. Because when you look at the underlying statute on this, I mean, it's the only main definitions that we see are customer, employee, and service provider. And so I think, Representative Niska, as you're continuing to work on this, just based upon the conversation, we potentially should have more definitions so that there's more clarity for everybody that's involved, both the employees and the employers, so that we can strike that right balance. So I appreciate the fact that you're working on this because in part, you know, I think that there wasn't quite enough conversation around this in the last session. I think that this is just a good opportunity to continue this work, which is why I think it's important to support this bill today.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska, for bringing the bill. Lawyer to lawyer, do you have a non-compete clause for your organization as an attorney?
Leader Niska.
Thank you, Chair Baker and Representative Frazier, as I'm sure you understand, the legal ethics prevent an enforceable non-compete clause in the legal profession.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do understand that. I just wanted to do on the record, we don't have non-compete clauses that can be enforced against us as lawyers, but we tend to make really high wages in the work that we do. Why, in this situation, would it be okay for someone that's making, let's say a nurse is making around $125,000, why would it be okay for that individual to be subject to a non-compete clause?
Leader Niska.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for that question, and that does get to a point that I wanted to raise in regard to the testimony about medical professionals, you know, family doctors, physicians, nurses, as you referenced. Certainly, to the degree that that any of the language could be cleaned up to make clear the intent on that, I'm happy to work with anybody on it. But certainly, the intent of the bill is not to cover normal healthcare practitioners who are dealing with patients in the same way that we don't want the reason why we don't why non-competes aren't enforceable in the legal profession is because we don't want to restrict any client from being able to choose the lawyer that they want to hire. I don't think any of us want to restrict someone from choosing the doctor or nurse that they want.
Representative Frazier.
Last question. No, I agree. I think that's right. We shouldn't have those restrictions there. That's why I don't support this bill at the moment. But what I would say is that as an attorney, if I was an IP attorney, I would have access to all types of intellectual property, proprietary information, trade secrets. I just can't. I'm trying to grapple with, in that situation, why it's okay for there not to be a non-compete clause enforceable in that situation, but for a nurse, maybe yes. I'm still struggling with that.
Leader Niska.
Thank you, Chair Baker and Representative Frazier. I appreciate the question. Again, I will reiterate my question or my answer about the nurse. I don't think that the point of this bill is to cover the nurse. It's to cover the engineer or some other designer who has proprietary information and can steal that and go to a competitor. I would also point out that one important reason or difference in the legal profession is that there are enforceable ethics rules around confidentiality that also apply in the legal profession. That's a little different than for the types of workers that we're talking about in some other areas.
Representative Frazier, any final comments
before
we take a vote? Go ahead.
This is a funny one. So to that point there about the rules that apply to lawyers in order to deal with those confidentiality issues, can you just like lay out the shortcomings of our trade secret law that we have here now and the reason why that isn't sufficient?
Leader Niska.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Thank you, Representative Frazier. The primary problem has to do with being able to enforce either a non-solicitation agreement or a non-disclosure agreement. I have written, I have litigated all of those things, and there are significant challenges even if you tell someone you can't solicit customers, you can't take a trade secret and go to a competitor. Every one of us has information in our heads. Every one of us has documents on paper. Sometimes employees download things to flash drives and are caught by doing that. Sometimes they get away with doing that. But it's very difficult when that information is stolen, when you're talking about proprietary information, to even prove it in the first place enough to get past the pleading standard, much less get into discovery and prove it up. And so that's why, in certain circumstances, a non-compete agreement is a helpful tool in the toolbox of an employer who has that proprietary information that they want to protect. And we as a state recognize they have a reasonable interest in protecting that to be able to protect it.
Thank you very much, members, for good conversation. I appreciate that. Seeing no other buddy on the list here, we do need to move on to the next bill. Any closing comments, Leader Niska, before I make the motion to move it on to the next step?
No, thank you to the committee for your conversation, for the discussion about this bill. I think happy birthday to Representative Schultz. I neglected to say that earlier. Now that he's older and wiser, I'm happy to work with you further on any definitions. It's important that we try to fix what was really not a well-studied issue in 2023 when this there was a bill, a more limited bill that had some committee hearings, but then the final version that was passed into law was never heard, was never even passed out of the House until it came in a conference committee report. So 1768 is an important fix to that law. Thank you.
Thank you, Leader Niska. Again, the chair will renew my motion to move, re-refer House File 1768 onto the General Register.
Mr. Chair,
all those in favor?
Can I ask for a roll call?
Yes, roll call has been called. Roll call will be given. For members, the chair will vote aye.
You were. Meckland?
Aye.
Bakeberg?
Aye.
Berg?
No.
Frazier?
No.
Greenman?
No.
Hussein?
No.
Pete Johnson?
No.
Wayne Johnson?
Yes.
Kozlowski?
No.
Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Schultz?
Schultz, aye.
And Zalesnikar?
Zalesnikar, aye.
Thank you, members. Seeing seven ayes and six nays, the House File 1768 is on its way to General Register. Members, we are on to House File 1355. Chair Meckland will step in quickly for my bill. Then you come over here when I'm done, okay?
Oh, good.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Representative Bakers. House File 1355, I believe there's an amendment.
There will be an amendment. I'll introduce that in a minute if I could,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Very good.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1355 to be re-referred to the Committee on Environment after this stop. And if I could, I'd like to proceed.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It was December 16th in 2024, this is last December, that I received an email from David Anderson to help on a piece of legislation, something called Scuba Lead Lake Weeds Company. It's all it was. As I read further, I saw what happened to his son Joseph last May. This is less than a year ago, and what happened. And then I read the same email 2 years prior, another young man, Brady Owen, which is why we're here today, is to address something that really was missed. The families are both with us today, and they need to share their stories, to tell us about Brady and Joseph, and what we need to do as legislators to make sure that we help this never, ever happens again. What we found out is that some operators do this service actually quite well. Decent training, et cetera, but some do nothing. And we need to make sure we get that side fixed up. We've been working alongside the Department of Labor to make sure that we have the language right. We're still working on this bill. But Mr. Chair, again, I'd like to also at this time move then the A2 amendment to the bill. And I will just describe it as simply saying the A2 amendment, we're going to call this the Brady Owen and Joseph Anderson Safety Act. So I'd like to move, Mr. Chair, that we include the A2 as my author's amendment.
So moved. Sorry. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Motion prevails, clearly.
You do have a lot of power, but not that much power. So, Mr. Chair and members, I need to turn it over to the families. And again, there's a couple testifiers, and I know that some might have to go quickly, but we'll see how this goes as far as other testifiers. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll bring in the Anderson and the Owens family. Thank you.
David and Laurie, if you will identify yourself and please proceed.
Absolutely. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is David Anderson, and I'm here today with my beloved wife, Laurie Anderson. We live in Plymouth, Minnesota. If I could, Mr. Chair, I know you have a very strict time requirement. If you could just give me a little deference, please. It's critical that you hear this stuff, right? We are strongly in support of this bill, and I'm going to explain the reasons why, tell you a little bit about Joseph, who sits there on your left, our fifth son, and really a call to action, please, for you, because there's just some urgent things we need to do before this spring starts again. Let me tell you a little bit about Joe and the kind of guy he was. He was 18 years old at the time of his death. He was a very active, safety-conscious kind of a person who was also kind of in love with the water. He was attending Bethel University in his final year of high school, taking college credits, right, so that he could graduate high school with the goal of having 2 years of college credits under his belt, where he could then come into Grand Canyon University as a junior in standing. So he was very driven to kind of get where he wanted to go, right? That spring, he was approached by an alumni at Bethel University where he was with kind of this offer of a great job to be outside in the sun, in the water, harvesting lake weeds, which for many of us, we don't really think about that, but there's actually a business out there today, many businesses actually, that do what is called scuba lake weed removal, where they literally strap on scuba tanks, masks, and gears, and you go down into the water and pluck out the weeds. Significant business for the land of 10,000 lakes. It sounded interesting to Joe because he could be outside with guys his age, be in the sun, be in the water, to kind of do that kind of fun thing. So he accepted the job. Laurie and I asked questions of him. It sort of made sense. We didn't get all the information from the employer, but he started that work. At the time of his accident, it was his third day on the job. And let me just tell you a little bit about that day because it goes into what this really brings about. Monday, May 21st of last year was one of those days in Minnesota, we all know, where it's so dark outside that the streetlights come on, right? It was a severe storm kind of a day. And he was told to go to a lake called Lac La Vang Lake down in Apple Valley, Minnesota. Lac La Vang Lake is a former quarry. It's what we call, as we learned, a dirty lake. There's no real input to it. It just is there, and the nutrients from the soil kind of grow those weeds. He got to the job site at about 8:30 that morning and was on the dock. It was his first day ever of using scuba equipment, and he had less than 15 minutes of training. And I'm going to talk with you a little bit about the training in just a second. But after 15 minutes, he was put in the water. He was told, and Laurie and I were told, that he was going to be operating in 6 to 8 feet of water, right? And that kind of made sense to us. Okay, that doesn't seem that deep, that scary. There was a young man, 19 years old, who was the supervisor that day on the dock watching. And after several minutes, they didn't see any more bubbles, and they lost him. He wasn't with a buddy. He wasn't tied off. He wasn't anything. He was by himself. That person dove into the water, his name was Ty, and searched for Joe in 6 to 8 feet of water, didn't find him. Ultimately, he did find him in 20 feet of water. His respirator was off, he wasn't breathing, he was brought to the surface. They put him on the dock, and this supervisor named Ty, a 19-year-old young man, was not CPR certified, tried to do something. He was not breathing. He was not responsive. Luckily, the Apple Valley PD and fire department was 5 minutes away, and they rolled a crew and got to Joe and immediately started CPR. He was given 3 epinephrine shots into his heart to get his heart beating again. Ultimately, he got his heart working, and they got him to Fairview Ridges Hospital down in Apple Valley. Lori and I were called at about 9:30 that morning to come as quickly as possible. We never were able to talk to him again, but we were able to hold his hand and be with him. Heroic efforts were undertaken at the hospital there to bring him back. He had a pulse. He was breathing on a ventilator, but he never regained consciousness. They brought him Monday night of the 21st to the University of Minnesota hospitals, where there are some of the best neurologists in care that you can imagine. And heroic efforts were undertaken, and they did everything they could. But after 3 days, he passed on Friday, May 24th, at about 9 o'clock at night. There isn't a minute, an hour, or a day where I don't think about him. It is an awful, awful process. As we struggled through our grief, everyone we talked to, without a doubt, right, who has either done scuba diving or been involved in the water or rescue or fire department personnel, all said this made no sense. How could this be? How could something like this take place with less than 15 minutes of training? This just makes no sense. And I'm kind of one of those people, and I hope I instilled this in my son, that you need to do something. You need to get better and not be bitter. And we had the chance to meet with Commissioner Nicole Blissenbach in December of this year. Bill and Dina and I got to meet her. Lovely lady. And we learned this, and this is what's kind of critical of why we're here. Minnesota adopts the federal OSHA law, right? And there are standards that we have adopted in the state of Minnesota. The challenge and the reason this bill is in front of you is there are gaps in the OSHA law of specifically around what kind of training needs to take place and what kind of safety gear needs to be on these young men and women when they're in the water. It wasn't that there isn't something there. It just says that they should have training, and then it says it should have some safety equipment. And what we learned from her and her staff and developed over time that you see in the bill here is 2 critical items. First, that the employees need to be scuba certified. And I don't know how many of you have ever scuba dived or done this, but right, if you were to go as your family on a vacation and go scuba diving in crystal clear, beautiful waters, you'd have to do these things. Listen to this. You have to go through 7 to 9 hours of online or classroom training. Once you complete that, you then go into a warm pool 3 feet deep with a dive instructor. And they teach you how to use scuba equipment. They teach you how, if your respirator comes off, how to put it back on. Because naturally, when you run out of air, you panic. So it teaches you those skills, right? That's another 4 to 5 hours. After you pass that, and only after you pass that, are you allowed to go in a lake. When you go in a lake, you go in with a dive instructor. They take you down. They are with you the whole time. That's another 4 to 6 hours. And then and only then could you or I scuba dive. Joe again had less than 15 minutes, and Brady, that you're going to hear about, had 0. They didn't have a chance, ladies and gentlemen. The second thing that's needed that's in this legislation is what's called a BCD, a buoyancy control device. I have sent to the committee a package of information, and there's even a picture of one of these. And the best way I can describe it is it's kind of like when you get on an airplane and the attendant shows you that yellow vest you put on your neck in the case you go in the water. It's a more sophisticated version of that. But what it has at the bottom, and you'll see on the picture, is a red handle. If you get in a situation where you need to come to the surface, you pull the tab. It brings you to the surface. We strongly feel, both the Aune families and ours, that if Joe and Brady had had training and had a BCD, we wouldn't be here today, ladies and gentlemen. It is just critical, critical things to do. So a call to action for you. I know you're very busy. I know it's been a hectic session to start, but we desperately seek your approval of this bill. It's not a Democratic or a Republican issue. It's a human issue. And I believe all of you came into politics to do the right thing and right wrongs. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a thing that needs to be righted. This is a wrong that needs to be fixed. And it's so easy to do. It's right here in the legislation. And then the last thing, please, is urgency. Again, I know you're busy. I know there's a lot going on. Spring will be here, ladies and gentlemen, before we know it. Both companies that killed our sons are still in business today. You can go to their websites. They're taking appointments for this spring. Without this legislation, young men and women are going to go back in the water. And it's not if, it's when they will die. We've had two deaths in less than 2 years. Please, please pass this bill to prevent this living hell from occurring again to another family. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Honey?
Thank you.
My name is Lori Anderson, and I am Joe's mom. And I'm just here today because I hope to help the next teenager and the next parents and family. Nothing that I say or do today is going to bring him back, but I do feel a strong responsibility to save the next kids. We were horrified to hear of how things went that day. My husband basically said most of the things I want to say, but I just want to also add that he was within 10 feet of a 25-foot drop-off. I don't even think he had any idea of that. We don't even know if the 19-year-old who was in charge that day, who was a fellow college student, had any idea that he was that close to a drop-off. We realized that there's just a hole in the laws. We trusted the company, we trusted the industry, and we trusted the laws to keep him safe, and there's just a big hole, and that's why we're here today. The big thing with those vests, I don't know if it's in the materials, but they are less than $300. And to think that that could have saved our boys' lives, it's so simple. And the certification just does not sound like a hardship to these companies. Many of these companies are already operating that way, that requiring that certification. So it doesn't seem like it's a big step or hardship for these companies to do, especially to save a life. The biggest thing that affected me when we've been through other hearings like this was to hear the scuba experts and some of the companies who are trying to do things right tell us that these two deaths were 100% preventable. That just really hit me. It was very, in my opinion, easy to prevent this from happening, but they didn't take the steps to keep him safe or to keep Brady safe. I just want to take a minute to tell you, I'll be quick, Joe was just a really good kid. He was, as my husband said, he was motivated, he was smart, he was a hard worker, he wanted to get ahead. He was trying to save money for college. That's why he took this job, because he thought it was good money. It was like $20 an hour. And the last thing I want to say is just that my husband said it's urgent, and that is something, honestly, that kind of haunts me, is the season is starting up again in 2 months, and there's just an urgency. I, as a mom and seeing this happen, I don't believe it is a if it will happen again. I really believe it is a when it happens again, if something doesn't change. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that. Next we have Dina and Bill. If you could introduce yourself and please proceed.
Thank you, committee members. My name is William Ani, and I'm the father of Brady Ani. As you know, two young men lost their lives working for companies doing weed removal. both young men were using scuba diving equipment that they were not trained for. I know in Brady's case, Brady and our family were assuming that he would be properly trained before he ever put on scuba equipment in the water, which was a totally reasonable assumption. The reason why they did not have the proper training and were subjected to such an extreme level of risk is because the employers did not have to do this. Only when you mandate employers to comply with safety standards will the job become safe for employees. As history has shown, without agency regulations, employers will take advantage of employees. This was definitely the case with dive guys whom Brady was employed with. He was paid $16 an hour for a job that his employers knew was dangerous. Although dive guys was fined by OSHA, this would do little to protect employers doing the same work. I'm a firefighter with the city of Minneapolis. When we go into fires, we use very similar equipment to scuba diving. In fact, we call our equipment SCBAs. We just leave out the U for underwater. Fire and water are both equally fatal if your equipment and training are not adequate. I think about how much training I had before I was able to go into a fire, and I think about how much training Brady and Joe had, and it was almost zero. I am forced to think of how many near misses there must have been before there were two fatalities. The only thing more tragic to me than losing my son at age 20 would be if this were to happen to another family, and it did. It happened to the Andersons. My regret as a father is that we were not able to move quickly enough to try to make this safer for employees. We have most of the pieces in place now to make sure that this does not happen again, but none of this will happen without your support to move this forward. You, senators and representatives, now have the power to save lives. I am quite certain that if you vote yes on this bill, there will most likely not be any more deaths. But if you decide to vote against it, I am certain that there most likely will be more tragedy. The industry did not become dangerous once there were two fatalities. It has been dangerous, and fatalities were inevitable with the lack of training mandatory in this field. The Brady-Ani-Joseph Anderson Safety Act is the definition of common sense legislation. We are asking for almost no funding, and this is definitely not an overreach of government regulation into industry. Minnesota State OSHA immediately recognized the need for this legislation, and they want this to go through. Every scuba diver that I talked to is shocked by this, and they want this to go through. Every senator and representative that I've talked to so far wants this to go through. But we, as the families of the two young men who lost their lives, were stolen, demand that this go through. Thank you.
Hello. My name is Dina Ani. I'm Brady's mother. Thank you very much, representatives and Chairman Baker, for taking the time to hear our testimony today. The following is a portion of a letter I wrote to the Hennepin County District Attorney regarding the criminal charges being considered in the death of our son. I want to ensure that in all this talk of regulations, that you hear the cautionary tale of what conduct is happening at some of these small companies under the lack of current regulations. Dear District Attorney, I know you are considering moving forward on Officer Nelson's recommendation of charging both the owner, Matt, and Supervisor Dominic of Dive Guys LLC with manslaughter due to the gross negligence she found in her investigation into our son's death. Brady was alive and well at breakfast on June 3rd and dead by lunch. He was ripped from this world in a neglectfulness so big in scale that it stole him from his life at 20 years old and from his family. He had exciting plans for that weekend. His car was packed that Friday with a helmet, skateboard, and guitar, and nice clothes he would never wear. The owner's carelessness with our boys to save a dollar shattered his family and left his big brother and only child on day 4 of employment. A few weeks after Brady died, we received a phone call from a gentleman named Rod. He was a retired police officer who had gone to work for Dive Guys after he retired. He let us know all the danger that Brady had been in working for Matt that week. Rod quit working there because Matt was so unsafe with these boys. Rod had over 1,500 dives under his belt, so he knew an unsafe dive situation when he saw one. He tried many times to call Matt. I'm sorry. On the antiquated equipment and the BCD vest those boys were not wearing, that they should have fins on, and they should have a backup breather regulator on in case they have issues. They should be trained and scuba certified. He complained that they don't always have someone watching the boys in case they get in trouble and don't come back up, like our Brady, so they're not pinned down to die alone and drowned alone. During the victim consultation with the district attorney, a year later, we found out that they noticed right away that Brady's weight belt was on backwards and inside out. Nobody looked at him that day. He couldn't release it when he got in trouble. Also, it was way too heavy for his body frame. During the investigation, they told us that they were lied to multiple times by the owner. But by interviewing fellow co-workers, they found out that that Friday they showed up, dive guy showed up at the wrong house. And the young supervisor, who was a kid himself, was in a hurry to kick off his weekend. So when they went to their fourth dive site that day, Brady was put out the deepest, even though he was the only new person. His partner said, "Hey, wait, I ran out of air. Hold on, Dom. I'm just going to go switch up my tank." When that employee came back down the hill, their safety supervisor was in the water working. He wanted to hurry. Nobody was watching those boys. He was quoted as running down the hill and saying, "Where the hell is Brady?" And Dom, the safety supervisor, was standing there with an arm full of weeds and said, "What do you mean? They lost our boy that day. They lost him for 30 minutes. We were told by the Hennepin County Sheriff investigator that the worst part that they had to tell me was that Dom never dipped a toe in the water that day to look for Brady. Of course, if they would have found him in time, nobody was CPR certified, so they couldn't have saved him. So we, his family and friends, are broken and forever incomplete. He really was a wonderful son, brother, and friend. Our lives have truly become a prison sentence that we must try and get through. He stole our youngest son and took his brother's wingman in life, his best man when he marries, and his children's only uncle. He stole our boy and future events, like watching him breathlessly when his bride walks down the aisle, the mother-son dance that will never be, the grandkids that we would have loved to have spoiled. We'll miss his hugs and smiles, and we know his laughter will never be heard again. Brady wanted to be a firefighter like his dad, and in fact, he was scheduled for the cadet class that started after that summer. He worked really hard for that. His 21st birthday came and went without him. He'll never even know what it feels like to be an official adult. Brady paid the ultimate price for the negligent workplace he worked for that week. However, we need to do this one last thing for these boys and help protect future boys to not become the next Brady. Just a little follow-up. Some of you may have seen the news stories on this, and that Bill and I stepped out on Brady's two-year anniversary of his death to that property to lay flowers in the water. You may have seen that we stumbled upon dive guys again clearing weeds at that house at the exact time. What you didn't see when you saw that those boys were unsupervised is that there was a boy in the water exactly where Brady died. And when his supervisor stumbled over to him after he had been down there for 30 minutes, he said, "How are you doing?" And the boy said, "I can't even see my hand in front of me down there, and I'm tired." You know what he told him? He told him to go back down there and finish the job. So, we pray our beautiful sons will be the last lives taken. Please help us to make this industry safe by voting in favor of the Brady Ani and Joe Anderson safety bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We have a few more testifiers to get to, so we'll move to that so we can get to the vote on this, members. Dan Gruber via Zoom, and then after that will be Ryan Mueller. If you can identify yourself and please proceed.
Hi, I'm Dan Gruber. I am a scuba instructor and instructor trainer for multiple agencies. I'm just here to kind of testify on the fact of the importance of the scuba certification, the class that once you go through mostly teaches you how to respond to emergencies that you might come on while diving. It's a big thing as far as getting people to handle different situations that may come up. But while you're training with this, you're doing it with a professional who does all of this all the time and understands how to react to these situations. Every instructor is also a rescue diver on top of everything. So they are, besides knowing how to teach a class, also know how to react to all different types of emergencies. They're also all CPR certified. So, if not a CPR instructor, so they can, react to any situation if there was an incident while diving. The other part that I would like to touch base on is the equipment that's used, and the importance of this equipment. There's a standard bit of equipment, you know, with fins, BCD, regulators, backup regulators. This kind of stuff is very important to use while you're diving, for different situations. I know there's been concerns of the BCD maybe getting, silt and everything else and not working properly. I can assure you that, I'm a instructor through personal or public safety divers. I've talked with some of the people that I've trained with, and these dive teams have BCDs that are 10 to 12 years old. As long as they're properly maintained, they will work completely fine while they're in the sediment and everything. Public safety divers are usually in the mud and in the weeds, everything that these the weed companies would be in. So as long as you were to properly maintain the equipment, clean it every day, there should be no problems with any of that the sediments or anything would cause for that. So, rescue divers, having somebody there that is a rescue diver is a huge thing just due to the fact that they know how to react to any individual that would have any problems while they're out there. But, in the case with both of these individuals, knowing how their equipment worked properly by being trained through scuba certification and actually hands-on with a professional helping them go through it and correcting any issues would definitely have gone a long way. That's all I got.
Thank you for that. Next, we have Ryan Mueller via Zoom.
Yeah, can you hear me?
We can hear you if you just identify yourself and proceed.
Yeah, thank you for including me. I apologize for getting called away. My name is Ryan Mueller. I am Brady's uncle. I also happen to be a hyperbaric technologist. What that is, that's somebody who works with dive injury. So I work at HCMC, and we actually do see people that are scuba divers that get conditions such as decompression sickness and arterial gas embolisms, and also drowning. So I'm a firefighter, as you can see. So I just wanted to quickly speak mainly from being Brady's uncle. I want to talk about, first off, what a special person Brady was. Brady was a very trusting person, and I think that's a very important point to make, just as the Andersons did. With this particular job, you would assume that there would be a standard of training, and unfortunately, there was not. As Bill mentioned, my brother-in-law, as a firefighter, we go through extensive training with our SCBAs. And Brady, unfortunately, was not able to receive that training. But I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about that. I wanted to focus in on the practical aspects of that as quickly as I can. First was just that. Brady had no formal training and was never required to show that he understood how to operate his equipment. As I mentioned, I'm familiar with the dangers of diving. Almost invariably, emergencies occur due to failure with equipment and lack of sufficient training. Why is that? Because of panic. When a person panics, what helps to save that person isn't thinking through necessarily logically how to save yourself, it's muscle memory. Without sufficient training and familiarity with your equipment, you're not very likely to be able to figure out how to save yourself. As firefighters, we are required to go through months of training with zero visibility circumstances. People actually will purposely make our pack difficult to solve, if I could put it that way. They'll create situations where our pack isn't working correctly and we have to figure out the problem while we're trying to breathe in the dark. Once again, we went through months of training with regard to this and Brady got absolutely zero and sounds like Joe got 15 minutes. Why I think there's such a parallel to firefighting is because when we depend on our gear to save our lives, what that means is if our gear stops working, we literally stop living. And it's a very parallel circumstance, as you can see here. As a hyperbaric technologist, I want to speak from that angle also. We're talking about death as being the only outcome of not having formal training. I do want to make the chair aware and senators aware that there is also injury that can occur even if you don't die. Part of what you learn when you go through your PADI certification is dive tables, and you understand at certain depths, you are required to make certain stops if you stay at a certain depth for too long. So I just want to bring this home really fast. We mentioned that there was a drop-off nearby for Joe that was 25 feet. The dive charts really actually start at 25 feet. There's an obligation for you if you stay too long at the depth of 25 feet. But in the case of if it's, let's say, 30 feet, if you work more than 6 hours, just a little over 6 hours at 30 feet, you have an obligation as you come up to stop at a certain depth because you're at risk of the bends. And obviously, a full work day is 8 hours, and it's very likely, especially if you're working in a quarry, that you could find yourself in a situation where you fall to 30 feet without even knowing it. So it's important for people to understand how to look at their dive computers, work their dive computers, and understand what circumstances that they are in. So we're not just talking about death. With death, we're also considering that there could be dive injuries. However unlikely, it is something that could happen, and it's important for the boys that are diving to understand this. And the third point I want to make quickly, once again, as a firefighter here, we are always going into fires with buddies. We're never going into a fire without a buddy. Brady was left alone. Think about that. Brady was left alone with gear, first off, that wasn't sufficient. He wasn't given the full gear. Brady was working on a job with no training, and he had nobody out there to help him if he got himself in trouble. And Brady had no way to alert anybody if he was in trouble. We have a two-in, two-out process with firefighters. We always are in there with a buddy, and we also have people outside that can relieve us or come in and save us if we are in a circumstance where we can't get ourselves out. And we also have a way of always alerting people if we are in a circumstance where we feel like our life is in danger. Brady wasn't allowed any of these benefits. These are just practical reasons. I can talk to you about how much I love Brady. I can talk to you about what an amazing person Brady was and how much I wish we had Brady with us today. But I realize the practical aspects are also what's going to drive this bill forward. I am in favor of this bill, and I hope that you can find it logical in your reasoning to see why this bill is necessary. As we mentioned previously, we realize this isn't a Republican-Democrat issue. It's just a common sense issue. And our concern is that we want to help the kids that haven't received any training that are about to sign up for this job this spring and maybe save some more lives, because we can't bear to see another family go through what our families have got through. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller. The next testifier we have is Tom Surth, I believe. And if you can keep it to 2 minutes, we'd greatly appreciate it. Are they on Zoom? Yeah. Okay.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that we keep the testify quick because we do have one more bill to do after this. So thank you for your shortness on this. Thank you.
Absolutely. Chair Baker, can you hear me?
Yep.
All right. Chair Baker, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I will shorten the testimony to respect your time. My name is Tom Seward, and I'm the founder and president of Waterfront Restoration. We're a small business based in the Twin Cities metro area. For 22 years, we've specialized in lake weed removal performed by scuba divers. In our business, safety has always been a priority. We ensure that our employees receive proper scuba training and have the right safety equipment. But I know that not all employers in this industry have taken the same approach. Sadly, it appears that the tragic deaths of Brady and Joseph were the result of them not receiving the most basic scuba training needed for the job. To do hand harvesting efficiently, scuba diving is necessary, but the nature of this specific type of diving is unique. It's often done in very shallow water, typically less than 10 feet deep. Often it is shallow enough where the diver can stand and their head is above water. While weeds can grow in up to 20 feet of water, this accounts for only a small portion of the work. Either way, at these shallow depths, risks are generally very low. In my 22 years of doing this work, myself and my team have completed over 25,000 jobs with 3 to 5 divers in the water on each. During that time, we've never had any serious incident or fatality or anything close to that. While the overall risk of scuba diving or scuba lake weed removal is low, a lack of basic training can turn routine work into a dangerous situation. This bill addresses that gap by establishing clear, reasonable training and safety standards that we think businesses can follow without excessive costs. As an operator in the field, I support this legislation because it ensures that all businesses are held accountable for providing proper training and equipment for their employees. We will continue to work with the bill's authors to refine the regulations. It's critical that we get this right so that businesses can and will follow it. The young men who lost their lives deserve to be honored with meaningful action from the state that prevents future tragedies. To the Onis and Andersons, as a father of a young boy myself, I'm heartbroken and cannot imagine the pain you've endured. I appreciate you bringing this to the legislator because change is absolutely needed. As this bill progresses through the legislative process, my staff and I stand ready to help ensure that all safety concerns are addressed and that the final outcome is a law that effectively achieves its intended impact. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. With that, we're going to move to member questions. Representative Hussein.
Chair Baker and the family of Brady and Joseph, I'm really sorry what happened to your child.
Pull your mic in a little bit. There you go.
Can you hear me now? Yeah.
Better. Thanks.
And it is a tragedy, and I do have a child, a boy, two boys, and this is not one thing that I would never wish to happen to. Those companies should be held accountable. They should be trained. They should be equipped for those childs. Because imagine, you know, graduating almost in high school and finding a job. You're excited. You don't know what you're signing into until you are right there because you're excited. This is your first paycheck. You want to make sure that you do the right thing. You want to make your family proud. And we'll pray for those child. They should be here with us. They should be here with us. You know, every person that should go to work should be back safe at home. And it is important for those companies to follow for the safety for the employee and keeping their healthy to be back at work. They should have trained. They should have equipment that and the resources that they need for those child should be equipped. This should never happen in our state. And this bill is very important that you're bringing forward. We need to make sure that we support so that we don't lose any other child. We don't lose any other youth in this difficult and challenges. You panic when you, even if you're in a swimming pool, you panic. You need the skills and you need the training. As the officer stated in earlier that firefighters and, you know, like people that dive, they need more training, hours and hours and hours. And I look forward to supporting this bill, and we want to make sure that we hold accountability for those companies that's doing the work. They need to take care of their employee, and they need to take care for our young generations. And thank you for both parents. For coming forward, it is a brave for you to come and testify in front of us. I'm really hurt. and I'm really sorry for what happened to you, Charles, and we'll pray for them to be in heaven, and they're in a better place for all of us. And I know we're not going to get him back, but we'll make sure that no more child is going to happen this. Thank you.
Members, we have a few more questions. If you can keep it brief, Representative Zeleznikar.
Thank you, Chair, and to the families. It's heartbreaking. I think I've heard a lot of testimonies in the last 3 years, but as a mom of two sons, and to see young men and women in this situation is beyond senseless. It is shocking in a land of 10,000 lakes, and most of them are murky in the state of Minnesota. To not have common sense practices in place was just unbelievable and unbearable to listen to feel the horror of your pain. And so on behalf of all of us here, I mean, there's tears and sadness because we can't bring your kids back, but we will vote for what's right, what was always right, to do the right thing and to save lives. And I'm sorry that you have this pain in your heart, and we'll pray for you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Baker, for bringing this bill and to the families of Joe and Brady. Our laws failed you and failed your kids, and this bill will save lives, and it's correcting folks. I know we don't have much time, but two things that came out of your testimony that I think we should think about including in this bill. One is the CPR, having somebody who can do CPR. I heard that from both of you. When I became a babysitter as a kid, I had to take a CPR, Red Cross CPR class, so having somebody who can do that life-saving resuscitation. I have learned scuba, and it took me 5 days, and I still went with a scuba instructor, and I couldn't do the murky water clear. And then the other thing that I heard you say is urgency. And I think we should put in an effective date that is effective upon enactment, if that's possible. And those are the two things, just in response to your testimony. Thank you. This has clearly been a lot of work, Chair Baker, and to the families. This will make Minnesota better and safer. So thank you for that.
Chair Baker, if you would like to renew your motion to send this to Environment Natural Resources as amended, and final comments.
Yeah, members, thank you so much for the conversation. Again, I can't thank the families enough for this. We do plan on presenting to the Environment Committee next, and we're still working on the bill. We're working in a super bipartisan manner, so if you want to sign on the bill, we'd love to have your support. House File 1355, and Senator Bolden and I are working across the aisle on this very much so. Again, we want to make sure we get it right. We've got providers that do it well. We've got others that are doing it terribly. So we're going to get it fixed. We're going to get it ready. And when it launches, it's going to be right. So with that, members, I do ask for your support on House File 1355 to move on to the Environment Committee.
Members, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Motion prevails. Yeah. Members, next we're going to move House File 1469 to be laid over for future consideration. Representative Spencer Murray, if you'd like to tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. Glad to be back in front of the Workforce Committee. I was on the committee last year. And so my bill is 1469, and through my work on the Workforce Committee last year and representing my district, I got to know an amazing organization called Better Futures, and I'm happy to present a bill with them here today. So the work that Better Futures does, I met them originally because they are located in my district in South Minneapolis, and they are ensuring that those who are leaving incarceration get a better future, and that all of us get a better future through investing in green jobs, and ensuring that those leaving prison are able to be reintegrated into society. I have testifiers here today who can share more about their work, but what I want to uplift is, you know, I think that the work that Better Futures is doing by investing in green jobs, and really they'll share more about their recycling program, ensuring that we are not putting things to waste, I think is a good metaphor for also the work they do with formerly incarcerated individuals. We know that oftentimes in our society we have an issue where when people go into incarceration, they can essentially be thrown away by our society, and that when they are leaving incarceration, they are not given the support to be reintegrated. So Better Futures does the work of ensuring no one goes to waste, and they are also doing really important work ensuring that we are dealing with our waste issue in Minnesota through green jobs. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you so much, Representative. Is this Mr. Allen? Yes, welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself and please proceed. We do have about 6 minutes left for the bill, so thank you.
All right, thank you, Representative Baker and committee members. First of all, I want to say the testimony before that happened before me was very powerful, and I'm glad you guys all voted positively to move that forward. I mean, that I had to take a moment after that testimony, so thank you for allowing me to speak. I'll be as brief as I can. As Representative Murrah stated, Better Futures Minnesota, we work with a population of men who have basically been disenfranchised. They've been basically locked out of society because of their history of incarceration. On average, the men that we serve have 3 felony level convictions and 12 years of incarceration. These men have very little work experience, and for some of them, coming to work for Better Futures Minnesota is their first time having legal gainful employment. As we talk about you know, these men and their inability to get work, a lot of employers say that they are felon friendly, but more often than not, you have to have a friendly felony, which a lot of our participants do not have. We serve low-level drug offense all the way up to loss of life. There are 2 populations that we don't serve, registered predatory offenders and arson convictions, and simply because the level of support that they need is far greater than we're able to provide. The work that we do, as Representative Murrah said, is very meaningful work. I tell these men every day, it is not glamorous work, it is not easy work, but it's very meaningful work. We provide over 2,000 hours of on-the-job training to these men across our 4 business lines. We have a stated goal to divert 15,000 tons of solid waste from Minnesota's landfills. We have done work as far north as Duluth and up in Detroit Lakes, as well as the metro area. Anything else I need to tell you guys about our men? Excuse me for 1 second.
30 seconds left. Oh, okay. For your testimony. All right. For your testimony.
So, yep. In closing, I just want to say this. Like the testimonies prior to me, this is not an issue that benefits one party over the other. It benefits all of Minnesota. And Representative Schultz, I want to wish you a very happy birthday.
Thank you for allowing me time. Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Allen. I appreciate that. I guess I didn't want to cut you off too much, but we have Tino on deck. So I want to make sure that we get to Tino Jones, who I had a chance to meet, too. So, Mr. Jones, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee. My name is Tino Jones, and I came to Better Futures in 2018 trying to figure out why I keep making the same mistakes in my life, why I keep going back and forth to prison. So I started off at a participant, and the tools that Better Futures provided me helped me out along my way. So I became a crew chief in training. About 9 months later, taking out crews. We're getting a job done, making sure everything is done safely. And then after that, I got another promotion, I want to say a year later, and I became the sales assistant manager. So that was important at the time because Jason Allen helped me work on my soft skills on how to answer a phone and deal with people, because at the time, I was just more about you deal with the people, I would keep the warehouse together, and I'll be the muscle. So, but Jason said that was an injustice to me, and yeah. So after that, I got another promotion, became the business manager, where I was running the warehouse. I was in charge of sales and in charge of appliances. And then after that, I did get another promotion. Right now, I am the integrated care team manager as we speak right now. Since I've been with Better Futures, I have not been back to prison. That's been 7 years and like 3 months. Me and my wife is still happily married, been together 11 years, and I own a house in Burnsville. This is what I love about Better Futures, and I really thank Better Futures at that time for giving me the opportunity to join their model.
Thank you very much. Members, just because of time, we got to move the room here. I'm going to ask for just maybe some closing comments, yeah. Representative Sensimiro.
Thank you. Would encourage anyone on the committee to go out and visit their warehouse in South Minneapolis. It's great to see the work in person, and I would say in Minnesota we have a waste problem both with stuff and also the way that we treat folks that are coming out of incarceration. Better Futures is a solution to both of those problems. So hope that you all will consider this for inclusion in the omnibus. Thank you.
Thank you. This will be laid over for possible inclusion. I have been to Better Futures. It was a great tour that I had. So again, thank you so much for presenting today. And again, members, I apologize for the brevity of this today. But with that, members, and thank you, Representative, we will do that. I'll lay it over. With that, members, we are adjourned.